So the topic is not-self, the last of the three characteristics. And I thought I would begin by reading this poem that I found recently in an ancient file of mine. I don't know where it came from, but I believe it almost certainly was a retreatant who posted it on the board. I see the pin mark in it. I don't know. So probably a retreatant who did it, gave it to me, and I stuck it in a folder and just recently found it. So I don't know who it's by. And it's titled Ourselves. We've put on our heavy coats. I, me, mine. Buttoned up against you and yours. As if we had to walk the asphalt in summer wearing layers of winter-stained jackets and mufflers. We sweat and chafe and come to an uneasy truce with the smell of our fear until we learn to inhabit the open air. So, one of the things that happens on retreat is we get to slowly at least unbutton the coats. Some of you maybe have taken some of them off, and it feels good. Or you don't even realize how good it is until tomorrow you put them back on again. Maybe some things you hadn't even realized you had taken off. But I like this expression, you know, we put on these coats, because so much of what we identify with, so much of our sense of self, is an activity that's optional. It's an activity that we put on, that we engage in, as opposed to something that's inherent. Or to say it differently, there's a tremendous amount of suffering around self. Self-identity issues, what we own, who we are, how people see us, how we want to be seen. And the self that we suffer around is an activity of the mind that has no inherent existence, no inherent essence of being. So the topic today is anatta, the third characteristic. And to back up a little bit about one of the strategies or approaches of Buddhist path to freedom is to address what the tradition calls the roots and not the flowers. So you could take off the flowers or the leaves of a plant. You can take off some of the stems. Even some plants you can cut down to the ground level. But if the roots are still there, the roots bubble up and sprout and they grow again. So we can let go of some of our clinging. But if the deeper tendency to cling is still there, it'll pop up again. In fact, if we let go of some clinging, there's maybe if we haven't really gotten down to the roots, it'll just kind of take another form. Give up coffee, and maybe it's that's fine. We can be proud of that, but then it's chocolate. And give up chocolate, and then maybe it's computer time. Give up computer time, and then it's something else. There's a need that needs to be addressed. So the approach is not to so much take care of the branches, but to really get down to the roots. Or another way to say this is to get down to the common denominator of things rather than the symptoms of things. So with the three characteristics, the idea is to get down to the common denominator of our experience, rather than focus on the particulars of our experience, the content of the experience, or the all the kind of varied ways in which our experience can be. So many of us are focused on our personal experience, our personal story, what's in it for me, myself, and mine. And it's very meaningful, I think, for many people to do this practice, to begin understanding the particular ways in which your mind has been conditioned and works, and to kind of go, aha, I see now how this works for me. And that's part of the value of the practice. But often it's you know, it's your own personal thing that we discover. But to really go further in the practice, the idea is to get down to the underlying roots or the common denominator. And sometimes, if you get down to the root, take that up, then you don't have to busy yourself with clipping off all the branches, because there's no more branches left, or the root is what kept it going. So the common denominator, to come back to the most basic building blocks of our experience. So this can be quite difficult because we're not interested in the basic building blocks. We're interested in the house that's been built, not the building blocks of the house. So the three characteristics are part of this building block, or the common characteristic, or the common denominator, or belong closer to the root, perhaps. So it's said that all conditioned things, all things that have the nature of arising and passing, are impermanent. All things that are conditioned, all things that arise and pass, come into being, are unsatisfactory. And then the third characteristic is worded a little bit differently in the classic text. It says, all things are not self. It's kind of an interesting transition. It goes, all conditioned things are impermanent, all conditioned things are unsatisfactory. But then it changes the wording and it says, all dharmas, all things are not self. And how this works is that there are some things which are not, there's one thing, tradition says, is not permanent, is not impermanent, that is not unsatisfactory, and that would be the experience of awakening or freedom. There's something about that experience that doesn't qualify as being impermanent, doesn't qualify as something which is unsatisfactory. And so it doesn't have those characteristics. It's not something about awakening, the awakening state, which doesn't kind of fit into the usual way we understand things. It's not conditioned, or it's not formed or created. And maybe it's something similar to having an experience of the timeless present. What's the nature of the timeless present? certainly we don't create it. Is there something else that creates it? Has it been created? Is it, it doesn't really make sense to talk that way. Has it been around forever? God made it in the beginning of time and the Big Bang, and forever after there's a timeless present? That doesn't make sense. It just kind of doesn't fit this kind of way of looking at things. And that it doesn't make sense. The timeless present, unsatisfactory, does it involve suffering? It's kind of hard, unless you cling to it, that in and of itself, you don't, it's kind of hard to cling to the timeless present. It's just, so the awakened state is a little bit like this. You can't quite put your finger on it. They say it's not what you think, awakening. So that saves a lot of, that saves a lot of brain energy. Why bother then thinking about it? And but then the way the formula goes, it says so all conditioned things are impermanent, all conditioned things are unsatisfactory, but all things are not self, and that even this awakened or nirvana or awakening or freedom or liberation or this timeless sense of present. That does not qualify as a self. It doesn't make sense to take that as a self. It's not me, myself, and mine. So there's a much more radical pointing to that. This is not No, nothing. Nothing qualifies as a self. And so part of the, you know, the common denominator, the underlying thing is to really see clearly that, to know for yourself in some very clear, obvious way, that nothing in the field of your experience qualifies as a self. And this was the insight, the teaching that the Buddha gave his own son. He's not often mentioned that the Buddha had a son, but in fact he was a father, and most of the growing up of his son was done under the tutelage of his father, not his mother. From the time the son was 7 years old until he grew up, he was, I don't know if living with his father is the right word, but he was a monastic, living the monastic life and under the guidance of his father. And when he felt, when the Buddha felt that his son was ready for full spiritual teaching, the teaching of liberation, we think that the event happened when he was probably 20, 21 years old. The son was, it's kind of touching. The Buddha felt or could see that his son was now mature enough for some other teaching. And so he invited his son to go for a walk deep into the woods. And they went in deep into the woods, and we have a name of a place, as the texts say, Blind Man's Grove. So I guess maybe a blind man lived there, we don't know, but that's what it's called. So into deep wood, and they named the trees that they, in this grove, it's called the sal trees. And the sal trees are kind of like the redwoods of India. Tall, straight, majestic trees, but different than the redwoods, they have these banyans. What are they called? When the bottom of the trunk comes out, and what? Is it ladder? Buttress. Yeah, buttresses. And so you know, these big buttresses, kind of roots, kind of come out, so there they went in deep into this wood to this grove. You know, father and son, and father to sit down with his son and offer him teachings. And the image of, you can translate this to sitting in a redwood grove, beautiful redwood grove, maybe the sun shining through a little bit, majestic trees and nature. And there's a whole different sense of, I think, of who we are that can happen. Sometimes we're in nature, in touch with nature. There's a different kind of sense of, you know, like the Buddha touching the earth the night of his awakening. In touch with nature, our place in nature. There's a kind of simultaneously, sometimes in the majesty of nature, a sense of a wonderful smallness of ourselves and wonderful bigness or connectedness or something. So that's where he was going to give him this teaching. The teaching had to do with this common denominator of not self, which I'll get to in a little bit. Gave out teaching. But earlier in the Buddha's life, or in his son's life, the Buddha gave him teachings also, and we have records of that he gave two other sets of teachings to his son. And the first set of teaching was his son was, some people say, 7, 8, 9 years old, and it seems his son was caught stealing, lying. It was not an uncommon thing for happen to kids. To somehow do something. And one of the Buddha's responses to this was to teach his son the basic principles of ethics. And the basic principle was to reflect before you do something of whether this is going to cause anyone harm, to others, to yourself, or to both. And if it's going to cause harm, then you don't do it. And then while you're doing something, to also reflect. This thing that I'm doing, is this causing harm to myself or others or both? And if it is, then you stop doing it. And then when you're after you've done something, also reflect. Has this caused harm to myself or to others or to both? And if what you did cause harm, then go find someone who you respect and tell them what you've done. You know, and maybe in Western language, it's a little bit like confession. But confession sounds dreary. like a punishment. But this is, there's something about speaking to someone we respect about when we've done something we don't feel good about, and just naming it and saying, acknowledging it, which then makes it harder for us to do in the future. It's kind of like we get the lesson that we need to learn from what happened, and then we can go on. So that was his first teaching, laying the foundation of ethics to his son. And then their second story is, we think that the son was maybe around 14. And, you know, at 14, probably the world over, since a long time ago, is when teenagers start getting much more interested in who they are and their identity and what they look like. And, you know, it's like, becomes interesting, right? Like hooking up and you have to look good, something. And so the way the story goes is that the Buddha and his son were out on alms round in the town, and I guess, you know, because it was his father, he looked a little bit like his father, and so he kind of felt proud of his looks, his good looks, and somehow the Buddha noticed that his son was kind of a little conceited about his looks. And so he said something like, I forget exactly what he said, but he said something, Buddha said to his son, he turned around to his son and said something like, I forget, I'm making it up, but something about the body, something like, you know, that this body should not be taken as self. And so the son's kind of felt a little bit chastised, like he'd been caught, like in his conceit. And so he went back to camp. And there he sat, and Sariputta, one of the disciples of the Buddha, came to him and said, oh, when your father comes back, you should go to him and ask him to teach you how to meditate. So the Buddha did, and the Buddha taught him first loving-kindness meditation. Well, first he taught him how to have equanimity, to some of the things we're teaching you, that that no matter what happens, you stay equanimous, you stay balanced. If something offensive happens to you, you stay balanced and open and receptive, like the Buddha said, like the earth. The earth doesn't matter if someone spits on it. The earth stays, you know, stable and balanced. Or be like the air, if someone swears at the air. You know, the air just receives and just goes right through. It doesn't matter. So he gave us analogies. You know, be equanimous. Just be open. Be relaxed. Don't react to things, as the initial instruction. And then he taught him to do loving kindness practice and the other Brahma Viharas. And then he taught him mindfulness of breathing. It's kind of a nice sequence. And so then he taught him mindfulness of breathing. And then he said something at the very end of that sutta. He says something like, and again, I'm partly making it up because I don't remember. I don't have a book with me. But he said something like, breathing, mindfulness of breathing is a way to prepare for dying. If you want to prepare well for your death. And but I like this because of the juxtaposition of this ordinary, very ordinary thing for many teenagers of conceit, of what they look like, concern like that. You know, their identity, looking for an identity, looking to establish, to be seen a certain way, to present themselves a certain way, is, you know, it's a big part of what negotiation is, finding our way. And then our society, unfortunately, sometimes supports teenagers and adults by reinforcing the idea that what you look like is how it's all going to happen, and so you have to wear the right clothes and trends and all that. And so, but then the Buddha offered his son an alternative to that, and the alternative to that was meditation, which is to discover an inner sense of well-being that wells up from the inside, as opposed to trying to find it from the outside through issues of identity. And I think that this issue of identity and how we create identity, live by identity, is an extremely important one for not just teenagers, for everyone. And so to understand how it gets created, to understand it as an activity that we do. So for example, it's possible to see it sometimes in other people. Sometimes it's really clear that someone is holding themselves a certain way. They have a self-image of themselves that they walk around with. They try to reinforce. They try to, like, other people understand them that way. And sometimes you just want to shake them and say, you know, get off it. You know, it's not. And all kinds of images, self-images people can hold on to. Some of them, you know, can be quite difficult to, for everyone involved. And some of them, you know, are trouble. You know, all kinds of things go on, but. And yet some, you can see sometimes how some people limit themselves by the identity they have, by how they represent themselves, how they want to understand who they are. Someone, you know, might see themselves only as by their profession, and that's the primary thing, that their identity and how they see themselves. Someone sees themselves primarily as someone's spouse, or someone's children, or someone's parent. Someone sees themselves as by their ability. I'm not very smart, or boy, am I smart. I know people on both ends of the spectrum. I know people who are conceited because they are smart, but, you know, they're going to make it clear to everyone. Their identity is tied up with that smartness, and they're going to be competitive, and they're going to, you know, kind of make sure that it's, you know, clearly established. And I've known people who thought themselves as not being very smart, and they weren't competing, but they were cowering. They were just kind of afraid, or, you know, shy or something. And so it's possible to see other people sometimes and see how they limit themselves by their identity. It's also possible sometimes to see how other people put you into a category, into a limited view of who you are. And it can feel limiting to be seen that way. Someone sees you by your role, and that's how they relate to you. And they don't really care who you are. They don't really see you beyond the role. Someone sees someone, maybe once upon a time, you made a mistake and someone felt hurt by what you did. And now every time you see the person 30 years later, the person is really hesitant around you, really cautious. And you say, well, you know, gee, you know, it's been 30 years. And, you know, can't you kind of, like, see I'm more than this and not hold me always, like, to that particular view of who I am? Or to be seen as someone's spouse. And some people, it's their identity. You know, other people mostly see them as, you know, you're a partner with so-and-so, aren't you? And that can be, you know, kind of irritating after a while to be seen that way. And so sometimes it's possible to have people do that to you, and you want to say, you know, I'm more than that. Don't limit me this way. But what's hardest to do is to see how we do it to ourselves. That we have ideas, we have concepts, we have ideals of ways that we represent ourselves to ourselves, or ways that we want to represent ourselves to everybody else. We want to bring our good face to everyone. We would like people to see us a certain way. And so we might censor what part of our life we share with people because we don't want them to see that part of us, because they'll think poorly of us. Or we put on a particular, you know, presentation so that we're trying to shape how people see us. Or how we talk. What we choose to talk about and say sometimes is part of a big major construction project, major strategy to try to ensure that people see you the way you want to be seen. And so it can be a tremendous amount of social gymnastics to try to do this. So what we say, people will kind of reframe or say, you know, all kinds of things to kind of, not because it's useful information for anybody to have, but in order to somehow paint the picture and convince that others that this is who I am, this is how I am. There's a story I've told a few times many years ago, it comes to mind again, of teaching on a Monday night back in Palo Alto days, so long ago. And an old friend just happened to come to be at the sitting. And I ran into her just as I was going in. It was like 7:30. It was time to sit down. And so it wasn't really time to talk. And so, you know, we said hello, and it was nice to see her. And so I just said, oh, I haven't prepared for this talk. And then I went and sat down. And so that was the last thing I said. So it kind of echoed in my mind. Why was that the most important piece of news? You know, I haven't seen her for a few years, and, you know, we have these two sentences, and then I said, you know, I haven't prepared for this talk. I mean, is that like, you know, the major piece of news that she needed to know in her life at this particular time? And I realized that what I was doing was trying again to construct, to have people, you know, to try to manipulate people so they see me in a certain way, or not see me in a certain way in this situation. Because if I gave a horrible talk, then I was covered. You know, I've been, you know, of course, it was, you know, I could do better if I'd prepared, but I didn't prepare, so that's, what can you do? And and so I was just kind of protecting myself, you know, from you know, how she was going to see me. And so how much of our conversations have to do with not about giving people important information they need for their lives, but rather, you know, we say things a certain way, or we, you know, in order to make an impression, in order to make an image, and or protect ourselves, or not say something to protect ourselves. And so it's a whole, this whole social construction, this construction of a self-identity, or presentation, a representation of who we are. And you know, some of it we do this kind of very conscious, semi-consciously, or some of it subconscious, unconscious even. And some of it is so unconscious that we don't even think of it as an activity. We just think this is how it is. This is what goes on. It's inherent. But as we meditate and we get calmer and more settled, meaning calmer means there's less activity going on in the mind. The mind is not churning and spinning and going so fast. Sometimes it's possible to see and highlight some of the selfing, some of the creation of self that goes on, some identification that we have. I am this kind of person. I need to be this kind of way. I need to act in a certain way to get people's approval. I need to, you know, how people see me is very important, and so I need to kind of do the social gymnastics to try to get everyone to see me. And like as I said to some people, I've heard this before, when I was at, I worked for a year in the kitchen at the Zen monastery. Zen monastery kitchens are social pressure cookers. And, you know, it gets very intense in there, interpersonally. And I was kind of the kitchen manager, head of the kitchen. So I had to tell people what to do and not do. And to give you an example of how, you know, pressure cooker it is, I remember going up, but what I thought was very gently and kindly to someone, and told her that because in Zen you have to eat in these little bowls, and the smallest bowl is only, you know, smaller, much smaller than a saucer. It's really small, so you can't, if the vegetables are not cut really small, they won't fit in. And so I went up to her and said something like, you know, the cucumbers need to be sliced a little bit smaller. She burst into tears. Big mean Gil strikes again. And but what I saw there, because of this, you know, this was such an intense place, that I had this neurotic obsession or need to have everyone like me. So it wasn't exactly having to do with my, you know, maybe it has to do with my self-identity, but I needed everyone to like me. And so I tried all these different ways of talking, of being, so I'd be seen and appreciated and understood in such a way that people would like me. And I don't know how well I succeeded. I remember one of the kitchen people said, Gil, we need to go talk outside now. And so I went outside, okay, I went outside, and he said, Gil, if you weren't so sincere, I'd punch you out. So it kind of worked, I guess. And in the pressure cooker, right? So, so that how I present myself and all these things. So what happens is that we create ideas, identities of who we are, which limit us, which are a contraction. And it's painful to do it. Sometimes it's not so painful, but a lot of our emotions that we have, not all of them by any means, but a lot, are often constellations or circle around or arise out of the self-image, self-identity, self-construction that we're operating under. So it's interesting that boredom often arises because it has no relevance to our self-identity. It's kind of sad sometimes to be in social situations where you can get people's attention if you praise them. You can get their attention if you criticize them. But if you have nothing to offer, there are certain individuals, you know, nothing to offer them in terms of either, you know, threatening their identity or supporting it in some way, then, you know, you're not of interest to them. You know, just and you just, you know, they're kind of, they walk away or it's kind of flat or not so interesting. It's quite sad when that's the case. But it happens to ourselves as well. And sometimes we spend a lot of times negotiating the world around this self-identity, what it's in it for me, how it reflects back on me, what it says about me, what it's going to do for me, how am I going to be safer, how am I going to be seen, how are people going to like me, how am I going to figure out how to get all these people off my back so I can be alone, left to be alone, I want to be alone and no one should be around. And there's so many different ways in which we kind of negotiate this self thing. And when we sit and meditate and get quieter, sometimes we can start watching the selfing arise, self-identity arise. And you can question it, is this really useful to go with this? Do I need to go with this? Can I just let it be? So it could be, so a simple example would be, I suspect that 2 weeks ago, maybe except for Betsy who's been living here, you know, but two weeks ago, I suspect none of you had any notion of your place in the hall. My place, my seat. But you come here and you sit down your place, right? And it's innocent enough, it's your place. And then you go out to do walk meditation and you come back and someone's sitting in your place. And suddenly it's your place. And what's been created is somehow, it's not inherent in the place that's yours. We don't have your name in it, stenciled in it. And at the end of the retreat, in 2 weeks from now or a month from now, you probably forget exactly where your place is. But while you're using it, arises identification with it. That some of you will get quite upset if you find someone sitting in your place, get indignant, self-righteous, that's disrespectful. How could they have not known? But it's not inherent in the place. It's a construct and activity in the mind. Now, independent of whether they should or shouldn't be sitting there, and that they should have known or something, it's possible to watch the activity in the mind be created, if the thought arise. It's possible actually to watch the thought that claims this is mine. It's possible actually to watch the creation of the idea really strong, locking in, this is mine, I'm going to protect it at the cost of everybody else. And, it's possible to go down to the dining room for a meal and start serving food to on ourselves and our plate. And then watch the birth of a thought. If I take seconds, or if I put more than one heaping thing on my plate, I wonder if the people around me are going to think I'm greedy. Or I wonder if they think that, you know, they form an image of who I am, you know. And I don't want to make an image of someone who's greedy. I don't want to make an image of someone who's a glutton. You know, I'm a Buddhist. I'm supposed to be renunciant. You're not even supposed to eat dinner. And, you know, I want to look good, you know. And so you can watch the birth of these thoughts and these ideas and concern how people are going to see me. And if you're quiet and calm enough, you can watch it arise, and you can watch in such a way that you're not so hooked by it and caught by it. And then you can say, well, I don't need that. I can let go of it. Whereas in ordinary life that's busy, and the mind is busy and fast, we can get all these ideas of who we are and how we want to be seen, and judgments about ourselves can arise so quickly, we don't see them as arising phenomena. We just see them as done deals. They're the truth. And we live, you know, as if that's kind of the nature of reality. So as we sit and get quieter and stiller, it gives us an opportunity to see in new ways. To see what we're doing. And in fact, one of the really important insights in Buddhism is to see what we're doing that doesn't work, as opposed to seeing cosmic consciousness, seeing the oneness of all reality, or seeing, you know, there's all these great ideals of what you're supposed to be about, you know, sitting there in bliss, or discovering cosmic compassion, whatever it might be. There are these ideals, we're supposed to get this thing, the it, I guess we talked about earlier. And but in fact, one of the core approaches to Buddhist spirituality from the early days is to be quiet enough, still enough, to watch and see what the mind does that doesn't really work. This doesn't work. Now, when the Buddha taught his son, he taught him ethics first, a good foundation, and then he taught him concentration meditation. Not insight at this point. Insight was what he did in that, when he took him into the woods, but rather to create a sense of stability, sense of well-being, joy that's not connected to how we look on the outside and what the circumstances are on the outside, but to discover some modicum of inner stillness, well-being, contentment, ease, perhaps. Some ability for inner confidence or trust, maybe courage at times, to show up, to be honest about what's happening. And with that as a foundation, then to have the ability to begin looking and seeing what the mind does, recognizing what the mind does, and recognizing what we do that doesn't work. This isn't working. To contract around this identity, to hold on to this identity, doesn't work. You know, it hurts. It's limiting, to feel how it's limiting. So I find it very interesting to feel the limitations of ideas, concepts of self that I have, thoughts that I have, be involved in a fantasy or something that seems so important. And notice how the more involved I am, the more claustrophobic my mind is, the more my world's gotten narrower. And then to ask and sense, what's right beyond the boundaries of that concern? What's beyond? What's outside? Or unless you think, you know, maybe you think rapid fire thoughts, so there's no space between your words. Maybe you don't punctuate your sentences when you think. But is there ever any gap between your thoughts? And what happens if you rest in that gap or pay attention to that gap or use that little gap as a open up and sense? Sometimes I've done the little exercise of, it's kind of, I don't know if I can convey it, it's kind of a strange thing to do, but you know, usually the eyes look forward, right? You can't really see behind you unless you turn your head around. But I know there's a world back there. But I can't see it because I'm looking forward. But if I try to imagine how vast the world is behind my head, it's kind of, I kind of intuit it's really vast. It's really big, even though I can't see it. It's kind of like it's just imagination that there's anything back there. You know, at the moment I have no proof there's anything behind me. You know, I have to, maybe you could tell me, you know, there's a wall and other things, but I have to turn around and look to get the empirical evidence. But the sense, the intuitive sense, yes, there's the wall, there's a building, there's trees, there's vastness there. I find that helpful sometimes to get out of the stuckness of the moment, the stuckness of my ideas, the limitations of identity that I have. I get limited, closed by what goes on. So we get quiet enough. It doesn't mean like we have to be that quiet. You don't have to be very quiet to see the really big contractions around self. But some of the more subtle ways we contract around self, limit ideas around self, need a lot of very deep stillness to see. And part of the value of concentration, stillness, stability, getting quieter and quieter, is not because it's supposed to get, it's good to be quiet. It can be pleasant, but, you know, deep, quiet, concentrated, still minds are generally overrated. So, you know, in and of itself, but they're very useful for the purpose of watching the activity of what arises and then questioning it and seeing that it's an activity as opposed to giving it absolute status. So then, at the end, the Buddha took his son into deep into the woods, and he sat him down to have his talk. And perhaps because his son was now an adult, he didn't actually teach him directly. Listen, son, I'm going to tell you something. This is how it is. But rather, he asked them questions. Certainly kind of leading questions, but questions. And I think of it a little bit like a guided meditation. And he was guiding him to feel into his experience. What's going on here? And he did it through this idea that I said at the beginning, that Buddhism focuses on the building blocks of our experience, the roots of what goes on. And so the building blocks of our sense of self, our attachment, our understanding of the world, our perceptions, is this sense data that we collect in, and then from that sense data, we build ideas of what's here. And that sense data can be, you know, put together in different ways by how we interpret it or the concepts we apply to it. So right now, this room is called a meditation hall. I can imagine having a different event here that's not a retreat but have a workshop, and we could call this this room the classroom. We can bring a chalkboard up here, and the people who come, this is, go up to the classroom up here. Or I can imagine that, you know, it's a nice floor. I can imagine that someday there'll be a party, and this will be the dance floor. The dance hall. And so then it's a dance hall. The meditation hall at the San Francisco Zen Center, beautiful, quiet, still place down near the bottom floor. In fact, used to be a dance floor. That's what it was. It was built to be a dance floor. It was a dance floor long ago. And now it's a meditation hall. So there's a certain way in which we overlay concepts and ideas on the basic data, floor, walls, ceiling. And so if you get really quiet and start being able to tune in to the basic sense data as it comes in, at the eye, at the ears, at the nose, at the tongue, in the body tactile zone, and in the mind data, and to watch the actually arising and passing of this data prior to building these ideas about what's actually there, then you can ask this question. In the momentary act of perception, perceiving something, in that data that comes in, is there a self found in that? And in and of itself, no. So even something as personal as your own hand, you take in the sense data of the hand. Is there a self in the hand? If you cut your fingernail off, trim your fingernail, and you have your fingernail sitting on the counter, is your self there? Is that self anymore? But you don't have to attribute even a hand as a self. But you see the sense data coming in. And there's no essential self in the hand. And so what we see, we can see it without attributing a self or seeing it as being essentially self. And what we hear, the Buddha said, and what you hear, is there a self in what you hear? And the son said, no. Is there a self in the things that you smell? No. Is there a self in the sense data that comes in at the tongue? No. Is there a self in the particular sense data that comes in through your bodily nerves that pick things up? Not in the sense data itself. And if you're clever, you might say, well, it's not in the individual sense data. It's in the composite, how it all comes together as a whole. But how that's brought together as a whole is an activity of the mind that it's possible to get locked into and limited by. But in the sense data itself, no. And is there, and this is harder, is there in the sense data of the mind, the individual thought that arises, for example, is there a self in that thought? When my wife was in her mid-30s or so, she needed, for medical reasons, to have a temporally induced menopause. And so she took this hormone in order to have this thing happen, this temporary, before she had to do surgery. And she, one day after a few weeks on this hormone, she said, I'm having these bizarre thoughts, but they're not mine. She didn't identify with them. She didn't recognize them, the kind of thoughts you'd normally have. As we're sitting here, I have the amazing ability, just like you do actually, to plant a thought in your mind. Even against against all your resistance, unless plug up your ears and don't hear what I'm saying, I'm sure you can steel yourself against this and no way. I'm not going to let Gil mess with my mind. I'm not going to let him plant any thoughts in my mind. But I can do it. It's pretty easy. So listen to this. No. And then tell me, when this thought I'm going to plant in your mind, when you have this thought yourself, as you see this thought arise, is there a self? Is that you having the thought? Is that thought itself you? The hills are alive with the sound of... So I trust most of you finished that sentence against your will. And when you finish the sentence, was that self? You're just floating up there, just a thought, just a word, music. Hills are alive with the sound of music. That can happen. Are you responsible? Is that some deep, dark self that's operating and conditioned? And it's just just boom. It's there. It is. It's the mind makes association, fills it in. How many of our thoughts are like that? How many of our emotions and feelings are that way? It's quite something to sit again quietly in meditation and watch the birth of a thought. And realize that there's no need to take that as self, no need to be defined by it, no need to be limited by it, to identify with it. It's just the thought coming. It was very meaningful to me one retreat where I was doing walking meditation, and to my surprise, someone started walking in my path. And I thought they were just going to walk around me, you know. But no, it was like chicken. You know, like I couldn't, and so I thought, this is obviously my path. I've been walking here for a while, and every day, and my place, and how could this be? I don't remember how the story ended anymore, so long ago. But what I do remember so clearly, like a felt sense, I felt myself get angry. And I could feel the anger arise and float right up and disappear. I called it, I had Teflon mind. And nothing stuck. Just, is that self me? Was it I? I mean, it's not happening to that person. It wasn't, you know, it was happening here to this person, but it was mine in a sense. But there was no need to identify it. There was no need to say, this is me, or define myself by it. This is, you know, just like the word music arose in some of your minds when I said that sentence. Causes and conditions come together. Causes came together, they're not walking. And this anger arose. And if I identified with it, if I'd taken it as me, I probably would have hung on to it and would have stayed much longer. But, you know, just there's no charge to it. Just, poof, there was gone. So the Buddha asked his son these questions. And the son understood that none of these things, the basic building blocks upon which we build our social world, none of these building blocks really are an essential self. And as he realized that, there was a movement in his mind. And the movement in his mind was to become disenchanted with all that, with the sense data, with the world being perceived in all the different ways we perceive it. And disenchanted means, it's not the Pali word. You can't do this etymologically with a Pali. But the English word, that's nibbida, translated as disenchantment, is a great word because it means that you've been enchanted. It means you've been under the spell of something. And that's the nature of suffering. We're under the spell of something when we suffer. And so this movement of helping the mind come out of the spell, to wake up, again, waking up out of the spell, but to get disenchanted from our experience. Not to dismiss anything or be aversive to anything, but no longer be in the spell of it. So in seeing that the sense data, of the building blocks of our reality, of our social reality, it does not qualify as a self, then there's a movement of disenchantment. Kind of, okay, I don't need to get involved. I don't have to pick it up. I don't have to do this anymore. And then with that disenchantment, there's a thinning out, this fading away of lust, of clinging, of craving, of wanting, of aversion, of trying to be someone, trying to be not someone. And then, with that, the Buddha's son became free. He was able to let his mind be deeply at ease, to have the mind or the heart rest in itself. Imagine your heart at rest in itself, at ease in itself, without any limitation, without any contraction around it, without any need for a definition or an identity, without any need for having a lack of identity, without a need to be someone, without a need to be nobody, but not involved in that, putting ourselves under that limitation that self-identity often puts us in. So this insight into not-self, and the wording is not-self because it's to see that there are things which don't qualify as the self. And so this seeing is so important. That's why it's an insight. Get quiet enough, we can see clearly that all kinds of things that normally we take as self doesn't need to be taken as self. We don't take it so personally. And that's the story. It's unfortunate that sometimes people translate the word anatta as no self, because then people think that, well, there is no self. And then once you start saying that, you're in the philosophical jungle you never get out of. So you don't have to, you know, it's better not to say there's no self. Never say that. It's just a headache. But you can say that all things are not self. That you can't find something, you can't see anything in its essence, in the building blocks of what we make up our experience. That is a self. That is a self. And to begin relaxing and trusting, just being present, just being alive, just being here, trusting enough that we don't have to self, we don't have to prove anything, defend anything, apologize for anything. There's a kind of tremendous strength and purity that can come from not apologizing, defending, building up, justifying a self. We don't need to. We can just be. So let's end now with a short sitting. So you don't have to believe or even understand the Buddha's teachings on not-self. But as you go along in your practice, it might be at some point that you see, you have insight, that there are particular things that you used to take as self, you used to define yourself by, that you don't have to do that anymore. You don't have to be defined. Maybe you don't have to be defined at all. And may it be that in this last day of practice, that you sit and you walk in the time that we have left, maybe curious about this amazing experience of being alive, this moment. Alive at this moment, curious what that's like if we were alive now without any self-definition. What's that like?